This is the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm Howard Jacobson of PlantYourself.com and WellStartHealth.com. This podcast is part of my mission to help you live a soulful and sacred life. So today's guest, Charles Eisenstein, has been challenging my thinking on all sorts of topics for about 15 years now, but never more so than with his latest book, Climate, A New Story. And basically, and stay with me here, Eisenstein argues that focusing all of our environmental activism on reducing greenhouse gas emissions to combat global warming is a bad idea, and it's not going to solve our problem. So you might be thinking at this point, uh-oh, has Howie gone off the deep end? Is he interviewing climate skeptics, climate deniers? Is he some sort of tinfoil hat-wearing member of, you know, all these thoughts are going through my head, like how you're going to judge me for daring to have a conversation that questions the dominant climate narrative. And let me put you at ease, because I'm a card-carrying member of the enlightened, scientifically literate, progressive wing of the American populace. And of course, I know that human-created climate change is the single greatest threat to our civilization, and that the biggest thing we can do to combat it is to reduce our carbon footprint individually and collectively. Heck, that's one of the best arguments I use for eating a plant-based diet. It fights climate change. It's better than switching from a Hummer to a Prius or never traveling in an airplane again. And of course, since I want as many people to go plant-based as I possibly can, of course I will deploy this convenient, terrifying climate narrative, which of course 97% of climate scientists agree with, to add one more reason to the mix when I talk to people about adopting a plant-based diet. Because after all, the last thing I want to do is stand with the crazy, greedy, deluded, ignorant climate skeptics, right? Well, after reading Climate, A New Story, I kind of have a different view on the whole topic. And I would like to share that view with you in this interview with Charles Eisenstein. Here are some of the basic points he makes. The Earth, or as Eisenstein calls our home, Gaia, is quite sick. Rising temperatures is one symptom. Just as like a high fever might be a symptom of an infection in a person. And think about how we would treat a symptom in a sick person. If it's a fever, we're going to give them an aspirin. Because the pharmaceutical industry treats symptoms and ignores root causes. And Eisenstein argues that the environmental movement has become mired in reductionist treatment of symptoms rather than addressing root causes. Eisenstein says that our planet is not healthy. We're living on a dying planet. Look at the organs of this planet, the forests, the wetlands, the oceans, the prairies. They have been destroyed and are continuing to be destroyed and polluted by human beings. Insect populations are plummeting. The bees are dying. There are superbugs that now withstand all our antibiotics. And a sick planet is going to be brought down by something like increased carbon emissions, increased greenhouse gases. A healthy planet will have the resilience to absorb a lot of that. And let's dig deeper, he says. The root cause of our mistreatment of Earth is that we don't view the Earth as sacred. And until we return from our illusion of separation, this story that human beings must control and dominate and bend all the forces of nature and the universe to our instrumental will so that we see every animal, every landmass, every tree, every prairie, every ocean as something, as some sort of product that we can turn into a commodity, that we can turn into cash, then nothing we do will help restore the planet. And he sees climate change as actually the climate crisis as an initiation into a new way of being. It's not just, okay, so let's put tubes in the sky to suck carbon. It's not simply switching to renewable fuel sources so that we can continue our addiction to energy or continue our addiction to improving our so-called quality of life by having more square footage, by having more stuff. Eisenstein is really saying that we need to grow up on this planet and treat it as sacred and treat trees as sacred, animals as sacred, places as sacred, and each other as sacred. That is going to be the root of planetary healing, not simply addressing carbon emissions. In fact, if we approach climate change like we approach our other problems with a war, like the war on terror, the war on drugs, the war on crime, the war on disease, the war on cancer, the war on agricultural pests, how are we doing with those? If we have a war on carbon emissions, we will fail because warlike thinking is the cause of the problem, and we need a different mindset to find our way out of it. Because as you know, there's a fierce battle going on, whether climate change is real, and if it is, whether it's our fault, and if it is, whether there's anything we can do about it. And like all wars, this one demands that we choose sides. So if you were to truly suspect me of being a climate skeptic or denier, you probably would dismiss me and this podcast out of hand. So I'm going to ask you, please listen to this conversation and please go get Climate, A New Story by Charles Eisenstein and read it. It's essentially a work of politics, economics, history, and science that takes spirituality seriously. In fact, you can pretty much map the teachings of Eckhart Tolle's book, A New Earth, directly onto climate. So if you've ever wondered what enlightened public policy would truly look like, Charles Eisenstein is as good a guide as any I've come across. So I'm thrilled that he agreed to share an hour with us, and I look forward to some spirited and respectful and loving discussion and debate from the listeners of this podcast. Two quick announcements before we get started. First, in case you didn't realize it, Sick to Fit, the book that I wrote with Josh Lajani, is available on Amazon in paperback. So if you're not a digital person, which I am not, I prefer to get all my books in forms that have actual weight, you can pick one up for under 10 bucks. So why not buy a box of 50 and solve all your gift-giving problems for the next 3 years? Second, if you'd like to become a certified WellStart wellness coach, if you'd like to help people improve their lifestyles, improve their diets, improve their health outcomes, and you want a plant-based slant to it, check out wellstartcoach.com. We'll be starting a new cohort in March. All right, so now let's talk about climate, let's talk about healing, and let's talk about love. Without further ado, Charles Eisenstein, welcome to the Plant Yourself podcast.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here, Howard.
So I wanted to talk to you about your new book, Climate, A New Story. And I have to say, I've been immersed in it, and it's kind of reminded me of a whole bunch of really important things. Like I was going to write a sales letter today for a service that I'm providing, and I stopped mm-hmm. because I realized I was coming at it from a wonky place. Like this book has just reminded me of so many truths. It's about climate, but it's about so much more. So I just want to start by thanking you. It feels like you've kind of helped me get back into the correct lane.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that. Yeah, from reading the book that I think that the climate crisis is a symptom of something much deeper, and that much deeper something, call it the old story or whatever you want to call it, it infiltrates our minds and our habits and our relationships in every realm. So yeah, like totally it affects how you conduct your business or your life.
Yeah, and I realized as I'm reading it, like I've read all your other books. I think 2001 was your first, was the Yoga of Eating around that?
Around then, maybe, yeah, a couple years after that, I think.
2003, maybe. But I've been reading your stuff since then. And every time I read another one of your books or attend a talk or listen to your podcast or visit your website or get one of your articles, it's like, oh yeah, I keep remembering that I forget to take this vitamin. Like you feel, you know, it's of course, it's not just you, but for some reason, I think maybe because we have similar backgrounds, the way you present these ideas can infiltrate my mind better than maybe like a Tibetan guru yogi or mm-hmm. or a monk or something like that.
Yeah, because we're coming from the same cultural matrix.
Yeah, and you're writing, I find it very reassuring and charming that you're arguing with yourself all the time in your books. Mm-hmm. You're saying, like, as I write this, this other voice in my head is saying, you know, bullshit, or this is embarrassing. So let's start with, because I feel like it's the same, you know, you're giving us the same insight throughout everything you've written in the last, you know, 16, 17 years. And it's about sort of the story of interbeing versus the story of separation. Can we just, you know, start there and lay that on the table?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess the lens through which I'm seeing the changes that are happening in our society is the lens of narrative, or you could even say the lens of mythology, because I'm speaking about the deepest narratives that we understand reality from, understand ourselves. It's like the basic cultural story that tells us who we are, how the world works, what's important, what's valuable, and so on. And this story gives birth to higher level stories that are still very deep. The stories that we call politics or money. I mean, money is a story as well. So, yeah, and these stories, these myths, the story of separation, for example, are reaching a point of metamorphosis, a point where they are giving way to a new story, or I would say a new and ancient story. So, yeah, the story of separation basically answers the deep questions of life by saying who you are is a separate individual. You are a soul encased in flesh. You are a genetically programmed, reproductive, self-interest maximizing biological machine. You are a mind looking out through the brain onto the world, but whatever it is, separate. And then from that, we see, like, from that, it naturally comes that your well-being comes through dominating the world outside of the separate self, outcompeting the other separate selves who are also trying to maximize their self-interest. So if you want to succeed and be safe from natural forces, and impose your intelligence onto the world, and collectively for humanity to impose our intelligence onto the world, then we have to perfect the technologies of control and the practices of domination. So all of that, all of the things that we castigate ourselves or society for, the damage that we're doing to the ecosystems, all of that is a natural outcome of the story that we are taking for granted as reality itself. The dominance of that story has never been total. There have always been, for example, esoteric traditions in religion that offer a different story. There have always been people on Earth, there still are people on Earth who hold a different story that's actually a lot older. And these lineages and these threads back into the past are kind of, you could say, these rhizomes that are ready now to give birth to the fruiting body of a new story, new to us, but actually very ancient. And I use Thich Nhat Hanh's word for it, the story of interbeing, which is, you know, it goes beyond interdependency or interconnection, because interdependency or interconnection kind of says, yeah, we're separate, but we need each other mm-hmm. conditionally to meet our needs. We need the forests to make oxygen. We need the other beings, otherwise we'll die. But interbeing says that we depend on them not only conditionally, but that their being is part of our being. And if a rainforest gets destroyed or if a species goes extinct, something within ourselves has died as well, and we become poorer, existentially poorer. So from the story of interbeing, we have a very different kind of technology, kind of different medicine, different education, different economy, different politics. Like even in a personal relationship or in a community relationship, if you understand that you're not really separate, then it's no longer true that your good fortune comes at my expense. but we can understand that what's good for one is good for all, or we can understand that the full expression of your gifts is going to enrich me too. So I'm not saying that this is true in every situation, but it's a different lens. It's a different default perspective that is rising in our time. And so, yeah, so anyway, I'm sorry to go on so long, but basically what I do in my work is I look at these different institutions and systems, medicine, economy, technology, and so on, and say, what would they look like from the story of interbeing? Like if they were built on the understanding that we're not separate from each other, we're not separate from nature, then what would they look like? And how can we transition from the old story to the new story?
Right. So I want to kind of, I want to jump somewhere that probably doesn't quite make sense to our listeners yet. So I'm gonna kind of stay a little bit linear, which is, what's the problem with the story of separation? Like we've had it for a long time. It just makes so much sense to me. It's like I look out the window and I see a bunch of things that aren't me.
Yeah. And it's not that they are identical to you. It's more that who you are is the totality of the relationships between you and all of these things. And if you strip away all these relationships, then what's left is nothing but a point of attention. And so I could get, you know, more metaphysical about this, but basically it's just to understand that you're connected to everything, and that also that you're not the only intelligence in the world, or that humans are not the only intelligence, but we are in a world that's full of beings, full of intelligence, full of consciousness, from on every level, the cosmos, the planet, even our bodies have an intelligence that's distinct from the intelligence of our minds. Our cells have an intelligence. And when we understand that, then, so just to apply it to healing, instead of trying to impose intelligence on a body that is just a machine, we can seek to unlock the intelligence that's already there, or feed it information that it needs in order to return to wholeness, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. So, yeah, and I'll just say also that one reason that it's not that the story of separation is wrong, I would say that it's a very, very narrow, narrow band of the spectrum of reality. You can do amazing things from the story of separation. You can build skyscrapers. You can build nuclear weapons. I mean, you can do amazing things, but there's a limit to what you can do. We thought that we were going to be able to use reason, technology, and I specifically the technologies of control to build a perfect society, and we would live in paradise by now. In the 1950s, the 1960s, this was an incredibly futuristic year. We were supposed to have robot servants and infinite lifespans and space colonies, you know, and the world was going to look like the Jetsons by this time. And instead, we have an ecosphere that is degenerating. We have social degeneration. We have economic degeneration. Healthcare, I mean, lifespans aren't even increasing anymore in the United States, not to mention levels of well-being and happiness. I mean, like something like 1 in 6 people in the U.S. is on psychiatric medication. You know, it's look at the opioid crisis, the epidemic of suicide. I mean, this is not a healthy society. So the promise that goes back several centuries of that reason, science, technology are going to help us create a perfect world, that promise is wearing thin, and instead we see all these crises that are in fact birthed by the story of separation. The ecological crisis is a direct result of seeing ourselves as separate from nature. and what we do to nature isn't going to affect us. So basically, the big picture is that the story of separation gives birth to the crises that transition us out of the story of separation.
Right. Yeah. So here's my like personal problem is that I see myself as a really good guy, and I try to solve all these problems as I can, or you know, either solve them or comment on them. But I'm firmly ensconced in this worldview of separation because it seems so natural. It seems so default. It seems like the only way to really see the world. And as a result, I get to demonize all the people who are polluting, who are engaged in sex trafficking, who are doing all the bad things. And I'm trying to overcome them, mm-hmm. right? Because I'm a good guy. I'm on the left. I'm a liberal. And so whenever I read one of your books or I hear you talk and then I post something on Facebook, everyone either thinks I'm evil or stupid. you know what I mean? Like I posted something that you had written like 5 years ago about like, is feminism really about taking women and putting them in positions of power in this culture that still degrades the environment and oppresses brown people in third world countries? Like, is that what we want? And I posted that, right. And like several, like my, you know, women friends were like, you know what? Don't tell, you know, like whenever I try to move to a different story, I get so much blowback from people that I see as virtuous.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember that. I was just pointing out that I think I have that in my book too, that the original like radical feminists of the 60s and 70s, they weren't just trying to keep the patriarchy, but put women in positions of power instead of men to replace the men in the same system. They wanted a fundamentally different system, like a non-patriarchal system. It doesn't change the basic power dynamics and injustice of the system to have, you know, Margaret Thatcher in there instead of John Major, or to have Hillary Clinton in there instead of Donald Trump, if they're going to be wreaking the same military havoc around the world. Like, that's not a very deep revolution. And these feminists of the 60s and 70s, they were politically astute and they were radical. So this isn't just like something Charles Eisenstein is saying. And same thing with Martin Luther King, you know, like he didn't want to keep society the same and install black people. He wouldn't say that, well, okay, now we have black generals and black CEOs, therefore my work is done. Mm-hmm. He was fundamentally a peace worker. He was.
I have a dream speech wasn't like, I dream that black and white soldiers will run together in the jungle
and topple other governments who are trying to alleviate poverty. And I mean, right. So anyway, but yeah, like, but this does get down to what you were saying about, you know, thinking that we're on the good side and the world will be a better place when we finally defeat the evil side. What that leads to is a polarized political landscape that is actually getting more and more extreme. And so you see, like in political culture now, you see each side embracing any narrative, any information that will, or any argument that will harm the other side, even if it goes against the things that they've been standing for years. So like the Democrats, they're supposed to be, theoretically at least, in favor of disarmament, you know, and peace. And the Republicans are supposed to be the warmongering party. But now it's the Democrats that are whipping up hysteria against Russia and, you know, saying that Donald Trump isn't aggressive enough in his foreign policy. And now Republicans in polls, there was a Glenn Greenwald article on this, are more anti-war than Democrats. And I'm sure that if it's a Democratic president that wants to pull back from Afghanistan or Syria or somewhere, then that'll flip again. So it becomes a matter of your side winning. And then a lot of politics becomes a feel-good exercise in thinking that you're on the right side. And I'm not saying that both sides are equal, and I'm not saying that it doesn't matter who wins. Like, all I'm pointing out is that it's turned into this kind of sports contest where winning, because you know your side is right, you know your side is good, you're on team good. So of course, anything that you can do to win is going to be good for the country and good for the world, because you're the good guy. And therefore, any data point that challenges your goodness and rightness, whether it's true or not, must be excluded categorically, because it's going to harm your chances of victory. And that's why narratives have become weaponized. That's why the news has separated out into two distinct universes, where if you're in one of those universes, you think that you'd have to be crazy in order to vote for somebody in the other universe, because they're not even accepting the basic facts. They must be total deluded fools. Yeah, it's, I mean, I could say a lot more about it, but that's the situation.
I think that's a good introduction to the topic of climate change. And so just to kind of frame it for you, so this podcast and my work is largely around, you know, a plant-based lifestyle. So eating, you know, less meat, more plant. And there's a very strong narrative in the plant-based community, like that this is the way to solve climate change, because eating more plants will, you know, we'll have less cows, we'll have less CAFOs, less methane.
Right.
So, and there's, you know, there's a lot of truth in that. However, what I realized after reading your book is that I'm part of a climate change narrative and push that's not helping. That we're not going to make things better because we're attacking a symptom. And so I'd love for you to talk about, you know, in terms of like how, like, you know, just kind of present the what you see as the straw man argument that all of us will recognize on the liberal left and on the pro-science intelligentsia side as here's what's happening with the Earth. Here's the climate argument. And then, I'd love for you to kind of explain what's missing from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so one of the general principles that I work with is that in any polarized debate, the key to progress lies in the things that both sides actually agree on unconsciously and in the questions that neither side asks. So there's usually a way to reframe things and to ask different questions that unlocks the debate or offers, it's not a compromise, but it's a third way. So in the case of climate, one of the different lenses that I offer is the lens of water. That says that the derangement of our global climate and weather systems has more to do with water than it does to do with greenhouse gases, that disruptions in the water cycle are far more damaging than CO2 emissions. And I have all kinds of science and reasoning around this. A lot of it has to do with soil and forests, and what happens when you cut down forests and you plow up soil and expose it to erosion, and it no longer can soak up the rain, so it runs off, creating big floods. And then after it's run off, because it hasn't been sponged up into the soil, then you have a drought because the moisture held in soil that's transpired by the trees extends the rainy season and creates moisture conditions. Not to mention that natural ecosystems actually seed cloud formation through various aromatic chemicals and even bacteria that live in the plants and so forth. It's like, you have to understand Earth as a physiology, not as a machine where you can tweak one or two variables, like as if you were changing the air fuel mixture in a diesel engine and expect it. It's not that simple. So then if you want to talk about agriculture, especially through the lens of water, but also to some extent, I mean, carbon's important too, because carbon equals soil. The word organic, as far as organic agriculture goes, that was invented, first used by J.I. Rodale. And why did he use the word organic? It refers to organic molecules, i.e. soil-containing molecules, I mean, the carbon-containing molecules in the soil, increasing carbon content in the soil, building humus, building topsoil. That's what organic agriculture is supposed to be, not as it is today where you have gigantic fields covered in plastic so that you don't have to use herbicides. Have you seen those? Like, that's organic, or hydroponic factories with don't even have any soil at all. I mean, yeah, I would prefer to eat that than something that's doused with Roundup, but it's not good for the environment. Whether it's raising vegetables or grain or meat, it's if you're harming the soil and you're harming the water, then you are harming the planet. And yeah, so what's the most damaging practices? They are industrial practices. So I would like to shift the conversation away from, you know, meat versus vegan to industrial agriculture versus local agriculture, versus, you know, industrial agriculture, commodity agriculture versus place-based agriculture, relational agriculture, community-based agriculture, where people are directly involved in the production of their food. That is actually a much deeper transition, I think, than just applying industrial methods to produce vegetables rather than meat. It's, I mean, whether you're producing meat or grain or vegetables, industrial methods are horrendously damaging. I mean, the worst are the confinement feedlots. Like, that's horrible for the water. But you know, those conventionally grown grains and soybeans, those are terrible too. I mean, what they do to the soil is basically dead in those places. The soil becomes, there's no earthworms in it, there's no mycelium, there's nothing. It's just like this inert medium where you add chemicals and you take away food. So that's, and so basically what I'm saying in the book is we need to understand that Earth is alive, that soil is alive, even that water is alive, that an ecosystem is a community of life and is itself alive. Then we can relate to it with reverence, with respect, with love, because there is something alive. And I would even go farther than that. I would say that there's something conscious that we can love and that we can be in relationship to. And if we don't go there, then all we can hope for is that we become a little more clever in how we deploy the, quote, resources of this planet. But that's not, I mean, that might be involve, you know, some external systems change, but that doesn't get to the core. The core is our alienation from a living planet. From that place, we're going to do harm no matter what.
Right. And so, I mean, your chapter on, you know, the spectrum, the climate change spectrum and beyond really blew me away. Because I think in the chapter earlier, you talked about the key problem is reductionism. Where mm-hmm. we're trying to convert living things into numbers. We're trying to convert complex systems into the equivalent of diesel engines, and almost everyone I know, myself included, has been thinking about the climate change debate in those terms, Can you talk about why that's inadequate, just to reduce everything to greenhouse gases and carbon emissions?
Yeah, I mean, it's very attractive, because then all you have to do is set a carbon budget, and you can evaluate every action and every policy based on how much carbon it's going to produce or how much carbon it's going to sequester. So it fits easily into a linear quantitative way of thinking about the world. The problem is, or one problem is, that it leaves out the things that we can't put a number on, which in the quantitative mind, well, that's okay. If you can't put a number on it, it's not real. What's important is to get those carbon numbers down. So then something like getting lead out of the water in Flint, Michigan, or banning Roundup, banning glyphosate, you know, like, how do you put a number on that? That's not gonna be as high a priority. Or saving the sea turtles. Or here's a big one for me lately, ending seismic testing and testing of Navy sonar in the ocean, which is deafening whales, like whales or even like killing whales, giving them, it's so loud. It's like, it'd be like if I went into your neighborhood and set off 165 decibel air guns every 10 seconds, night and day for weeks and months at a time. Mm-hmm. That's how it is for the whales and the dolphins. Well, okay, we all think that that's bad, but it's not a threat to the planet, because what's the effect on carbon of those things? Put a number on that. So if we have numbers-based policy, then that kind of thing gets relegated to secondary status. It becomes a lower priority. But when you understand Earth as a living being, then you know that any harm to its organs, like the whales, or the forests, or the coral reefs, any harm to its organs is going to cause the planet to die of organ failure, or it's going to reduce the resiliency of the planet. And so from that perspective, wow, we better stop that seismic testing, because the whales can't communicate anymore. It's like they stop singing. Mm. What's the carbon score of that? I mean, actually, it probably does affect carbon, because everything is interconnected. And now if the whales are deafened, they can't coordinate their migrations anymore and bring nutrients from their feeding grounds to their birthing grounds. They transfer enormous amount of nutrients that allow life to thrive in the places where they give birth. So they, you know, actually whales are part of a nutrient transport system and part of a marine physiology. And so they bring the nutrients, and then kelp can grow and shellfish can grow, and they sequester carbon through their shells. So you could say, well, actually whales do have a carbon score.
Sure, but it's unpredictable.
Right, you can't.
Right, it's like that stuff when they returned the wolves to Yellowstone, and they just, right, like all the downstream benefits that no one was predicting.
Right. Right. So that's right. So I think that we need an ecological holistic understanding as a guide to our collective choices, and not a carbon budget. And if you do, like, see, that's the other thing is that, I mean, take seismic testing. That's done to explore for oil and gas. So if you say, okay, like, and this is a thought experiment I go into my book, I say, okay, what if the climate skeptics are right? What if the recent warming is just the rising part of a sine wave, not a, you know, endlessly rising curve? What if they're right that it was warmer in the medieval warm period and the Roman warm period and the Minoan warm period and the early Holocene? What if, I mean, there's all these things that they have, like, it's like one of these alternate universes, right? The climate skeptic universe. What if they're right? Well, from the living planet view, and from the reverence for life view, I would still be opposed to seismic testing. I would still be opposed to drilling offshore for oil and gas, because the oil spills devastate marine life. I would still be opposed to tar sands excavation. I mean, have you seen like the forests that are replaced by these pits and toxic pools, you know, and wastelands? No, none of that.
Yeah,
No
but you're
mountaintop removal, no fracking, no pipelines.
yeah, but
Actually,
you're saying that the evidence of my eyes, that looking at something and deeming it ugly, and looking at and thinking of whales and feeling like crying in sorrow is as good a measure of what we should be doing as like the science establishment measuring carbon and carbon offsets.
yeah, and I'm not saying, you know, ignore science. Science is a way to expand the scope of our vision so that we can see things we couldn't have seen before. And I think that, I mean, I do think that we should cut carbon emissions. That high levels of greenhouse gases put more stress on a system that is already severely degraded through ecocide. I mean, the organs of this planet are really stressed. Half of all the mangroves are gone. 80% of the seagrass meadows in New England are gone. There's almost no high grass prairie left in North America. Like all of the systems that maintain a really strong, resilient planet have been degraded. What's left? I mean, the Amazon is still left, most of it. The Congo. These are, if I were like world dictator, I would say first priority is to preserve those. Those need to be absolutely sacrosanct because Gaia's knowledge of health still is intact in those places. It's a reservoir of the memory of health for the planet. Second priority is regeneration, to restore, to reforest, to rebuild soil, regenerative agriculture. So first, conservation. We need marine conservation zones. There was one proposal to put half of all the world's oceans in marine conservation zones. Like, yeah, let's do stuff like that. Third priority is to stop dousing the entire landscape in pesticides, and toxic pollution, and I hate to say it, but radio and microwave pollution, electromagnetic pollution. I mean, this is, if you look into 5G and some of the non-mainstream information about that, it's pretty horrifying what it does to humans and what it does to insects and wildlife. And then my fourth priority, still important, but fourth, is to cut greenhouse gases. But that would be a natural byproduct of the first three anyway.
Right, but what I'm getting at is you're giving me permission to trust my heart, right? So so environmentalists are degraded as tree huggers, and some of us have adopted that as a term of pride in the same way that any minority that gets labeled with something may try to appropriate it, but like to say like I am a tree hugger, like literally say that I love nature. I love trees. I love walking. I saw a little snail crossing the road this morning, and like, with your book in my ear, like my heart went out to this little slimy guy. Like that's not only, it's not something to be ashamed of, and in fact, it's as worthy as a driver of policy as all the scientific think tanks that are coming that are just reducing things to numbers. I find that so empowering and beautiful.
There's a part in my book where I said, okay, you know, environmentalist, you might give arguments about, well, we need to cut greenhouse gases, or we need to preserve this or do that, because if we don't, here are the bad things that'll happen to us, here are the economic costs. And they're trying to speak the language of policy, because that's what counts in policy. It's the costs and benefits. But I say, but come on, admit it. That's not the real reason why you're doing this. The real reason is because you're a tree hugger. You're a bird lover. You're a butterfly watcher. You're a turtle caresser, you know? Like, that's who you are. Come on. Like, admit it. It's not that you're making some implicit rational calculation that ecocide is going to eventually harm you or your grandchildren. even if it weren't. Like, and that was another, that's another thought experiment I do. I say, okay, well, suppose we could get away with it. Suppose we had the technology, had the know-how and the capability to replace every ecosystem service with a technological service, to replace the forests that produce oxygen with concrete algae pools, to have carbon sucking machines to maintain atmospheric balance, to have bubble cities that keep out all the toxic pollution, to have vat grown food that tastes almost as good or just as good thanks to the miracle of chemistry. And what if we could create a world like that, a gigantic strip mine and waste dump with bubble cities and beautiful digital displays of nature scenes, VR of nature, to replace the nature that's gone and dead, and rising lifespans and higher literacy and all the things that Steven Pinker says prove that the world is better and better. What if we could create that world? Nature gone and dead, but humans just fine. Would we do it? Would you want to do that? And if you do not want that, then you have to have some other argument besides metrics of human well-being. You need some other reason. When someone says, well, why should I care? Why should we preserve the rainforest? Why should we preserve the whales? What reason can you give? Besides, if you don't, bad things will happen to you. The only reason is because we love them, because they are sacred. That's the reason we need to step into. And so, yeah, like that starts on a very personal level. It starts on a ceremonial level. It starts by giving attention and care to whatever form of life presents itself to you. And as you do that, you strengthen the field of love for life that eventually affects our systems, our politics. But that's where it's got to come from. Not, okay, we're going to be a little bit more clever about maximizing human well-being. And it's not even working. Yeah, we have higher lifespans. We have higher literacy. We have higher GDP. We have more floor space per capita, twice as much as two generations ago. So we're better off, right? Happier than we were in 1960, right? No, it's not even working. And the reason is that we are not separate from the rest of life. Even if we can insulate ourselves from the consequences that we can measure, the unmeasurable consequences still get in under our fortress walls, and we're miserable.
Well, and you begin the book by pointing out that the consensus narrative from the left is that we're addicted to fossil fuels. And,
yeah.
And you jump on that word addiction and take it very literally and say, like, what, you know, addiction is something that we do to make up for some deep lack.
Yeah.
Right. So, right. So that, yeah. So, and I could, and you have this, this paragraph that you quote from your previous book, The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible, that like had me, I was trying to read it to my wife and I was like, you know, crying, trying to get the words out. I'm not finding it in the, I didn't write down what page it was on, but you know, how much, basically you start at how much ugly do we need to compensate for a loss of beauty? How many adventure movies do we have to watch to compensate for a lack of true adventure in our lives? Like, mm-hmm. Right. Like the addiction, right. The whole addiction model of, you know, addictive food or drugs or sex or work is based on the fact that we're, you know, it's infinite because we're never going to meet our needs. We're never going to get our need for vitamin C from M&Ms.
Right.
And so talk about what you think the need is that we are fueling with our addictions to fuel.
Yeah. You know what? Maybe I'll go grab that that passage.
Okay.
I could probably find it online very quickly.
Here it is, page 20,
oh, you got it.
Page 209.
Okay.
And I was reading, just to bookend it, the two parts of the book that have, like, you know, that pierced me, was that paragraph, which obviously I read, you know, 6 years ago, but it didn't stick in the same way. And the woman in India who was talking about what happened when her family became wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody moved away, and there was no one to hear the couples argue, and there was no one for the children to play with now that they all had their own homes and,
right.
and they had higher standards of living. And like those
right.
two were sort of the narratives that broke my heart.
Yeah. According to every metric, that woman's family's better off. You know, they each have their own house. They have more floor space per family member. They have higher income. They're producing and purchasing more goods and services. They all now have access to childcare, and they can all pay for childcare. But when she was growing up, they didn't need to pay for childcare because there were dozens of kids in the household, this extended family. They always had playmates. There was no such thing as a play date, you know. There was no such thing as boredom. And they had free reign of the outdoors around them. That was their territory. That was their turf. So, yeah, it illustrates the problem with metrics, is that it leaves out the things that you can't measure, that are unmeasurable, or that you simply choose not to measure because it's inconvenient. Like, usually what's measured are the things that contribute to the interests of the people doing the measuring, the things that they think are important, and who gets left out.
Right. And
those who are.
And as you said, like, what we don't measure could be defined as our shadow.
Right.
Right. We don't. It's not like we're deliberately leaving them out. So we don't even think about counting them.
Right. It just doesn't seem important to us. Like, we don't even know to measure it.
Right.
I was with a woman recently who works with one of the Kogi mamas. You know, the Kogi are this indigenous nation in Colombia that are very, very, very traditional in their practices. And they call themselves elder brother and us younger brother. And they're like, younger brother is messing things up here. We need to teach him some things about how to run a planet, you know? And they're really big into ceremony, and they say that they say a lot of stuff that echoes what I say in my book, that there are certain special places on Earth that are the deep reservoirs of the mind of the planet and the health of the planet. And if you destroy those, then the planet will die. They also speak a lot about ceremony and the importance of doing the right ceremonies in sacred places on Earth, or places where there's been trauma, places that need healing. So one of them was out in California, and he's like, this is a few years ago, he's like, you better do some ceremonies here, here, and here, because if you don't, there are going to be really bad fires. And his words were not heeded. And turns out there were really bad fires. And he came back the next year and he said, you have to do ceremonies here, here, and here, or the fires will even be worse next year. And that came true too. And then he came again, said the same thing. And they're like, how could it be any worse? And then this year there was the campfire that was even worse. So, like this, and I've heard other indigenous people speak in this way too, basically saying that humans and the rest of the planet have a covenant that is maintained through ceremony and maintained through respectful relations with other beings. And the Gaia's part of the deal is to maintain a macro environment that's suitable for human habitation. And if we break our end of the deal, then the other end of the deal will not be upheld either. And we'll have climate derangement, fires, droughts, floods, and so forth. Like, I've heard many indigenous people from totally different, I've heard Dogon people say pretty much the same thing. So you know, you can translate whale well-being into the language of science. It's a lot harder to translate the beliefs of the Kogi or the Dogon into quantitative language, but it sure speaks to me and invites me. And I could say more having a intimate sacred relationship with other beings, it meets a deep need that, to return to the addiction metaphor, that if that need isn't met, then we compensate through consumption. There's a kind of a security in being enmeshed in a web of belonging, in community, in relation to nature, soil, plants, animals, the seasons, that makes us feel at home in the world. And that feeling of, and that's a deep kind of security. If you don't have that, you're going to be anxious. You're going to be depressed. You're going to always be hungry for something. You're going to be hungry for a bigger bank account, for more money, more security, more investments. But how much to maybe you want to read that little passage, like how much money do you need to have the kind of security that comes through deep relationships? No amount is enough.
Right. And I'll get to that paragraph, but I'm thinking like, you know, in my work, I teach people how to be healthy. And of course, people come to me largely because they want to lose weight, which is, it's a numerical thing. And people do all sorts of things to lose weight. And a lot of them work, from, you know, cocaine to, crazy diets to restriction of the, you know, they work for a while. But I'm trying to teach people, like, it's about, if you do the things that will make you healthy, the weight will be an afterthought. It will be an accidental or incidental side effect. And I think you're saying the same thing about these Kogi ceremonies, that if your come from is we need to reduce greenhouse gases, we need to lower the temperature of the earth. Yeah, but if all we're doing is that, then we're going to manipulate ecosystems. We're going to destroy land and displace peasants to put up biofuel. We're going to put up more dams. But if our goal is the health and the healing and the unity and beauty of the planet, then the carbon emissions are going to go down naturally without us making that the only thing that matters.
Right. And if we don't do that stuff, then no matter how hard we try, we're not going to bring carbon emissions down. We've been trying since, 1992 to bring them down. They're more than 50% higher than they were in 1992. We're swimming against the tide. Basically, we have a system that only works with increasing consumption, only works economically, only works psychologically because of these unmet needs that we have for community, intimacy, relationship, authenticity, belonging, and so forth. So we maintain those, but then we try to limit the addictive meeting of those needs with, a carbon tax or something like that. We haven't even done that. Like, it's impossible, I think, to bring down carbon emissions when we live in a system that requires more and more consumption for its maintenance.
Well, I'm not willing to have a lower standard of living, right? Just and I think what you're saying is, like, we're thinking about this in terms of, well, we've got to, we're screwed. We have to, downsize. We need to have smaller, like I need to have less of a life. And when you describe this woman in India, like, God, would I love a compound with hundreds of beloveds that I know, and, cranky uncles that I can't stand, but just to be embedded, like, to have that safety, to feel a living planet under my feet. I would probably, give up my noise canceling headset and my iPad. Right.
Yeah, like, that's a good example. Do you need a noise canceling headset if you live somewhere where you don't hear highway noise and traffic and airplanes, but instead you hear birds and children playing and the crickets, you know? You don't want noise-canceling headsets then.
Right.
So basically, we created a situation where we need more and more technology to insulate ourselves from the effects of all that technology. I mean, the same thing in the health food thing, you know? Like you import pristine supplements from Iceland or from wherever, like the... And you know, these fancy minerals and things like that, when, yeah, like you need that when the soil has been so depleted, and when we're cut off from deep relationships to plants, you know, where we could, where we would know how to nourish ourselves on subtle levels. Fighting the symptom, while letting the disease progress. That's what we're doing as a society.
Right. And the other thing you point out is that if we're using the language of self-interest and we're using carbon taxes and credits and basically bribes and threats, carrots and sticks, the way we always do in the story of separation, then we're just going to get a society that's doing just enough to not get caught. The same way you described, like, okay, I'm gonna treat my child like an automaton and make sure he has the proper nutrient, you know, quantities and the proper warmth, you know, proper ambient temperature, as opposed to this boy I love.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's just the way that this is an outgrowth of the story of separation. You find a cause to attack, something that's causing the problem. So you gave the example of weight loss. This is really similar to the mindset of carbon fundamentalism. You know, it's calorie fundamentalism. So that in that mindset, the way to lose weight is to eat less or burn more calories. Just like the way to have a healthy climate is to emit less or sequester more. Same logic. But it's not asked, well, why am I eating more than I need? What are the conditions for this excess consumption? Am I eating because I'm lonely? Am I eating because I'm stressed? Am I eating because I am depressed? Like, why? Am I eating because I want some excitement in life? Because I want a break from my tedious routine? Like, so to force yourself to eat less is a perfect example of attacking the symptom while leaving the cause untouched. And that sets up an endless war against the self, an endless struggle of willpower versus desire, which is unnecessary when you do see and then change the underlying conditions that's generating the addiction. So yeah, same thing with fossil fuels. And like you were saying, this is not, the solution isn't to make do with less of what we already have. It's a total transformation. And it's actually a positive transformation. People will be happier in bikeable, walkable communities than they will be in McMansions, where every function has been privatized and made indoors. I recently watched a Charlie Chaplin movie with my six-year-old. The Kid, it was called, you know, and it's really funny, you know, and there's like no special effects in this movie. They don't even have sound. It was a silent movie. But what I noticed, you know, the scenes, like there was public life. There was street life. You know, you would go out onto the street and there were people out there. Mm. There were conversations happening. People were gathering. There were arguments. There were fights, you know, but it was like life was public. When life is public, you don't need so much of the private. So, or you could say, well, you're greedy and bad for wanting an SUV and a McMansion and so forth, and you should make do with less. Mm-hmm. You should make do with less, you know, electronics and less comforts and without your espresso maker and without this and without that. But those things are a response and in some cases a necessity given the society that we live in. People are miserable. That's why they're addicted. So this, you know, what I'm proposing in my book, and lots of other people are moving in this direction too, it's actually an increase in our quality of life, but just not according to traditional measures. It may not be an increase in GDP, may not be an increase in BTUs of energy consumed per person, or miles driven per person, or healthcare dollars per capita. But I mean, you're in the alternative health field, you know that the things that you teach and practice do not require higher expenditures of GDP per capita.
Yeah, I have a startup where we're trying to tell people that you can spend less, and we're having a really, like to me, the argument is, even from a completely, self-interested point of view, is like, hey, if you bring us in, we'll teach your people how to be healthier. We'll get them off their meds. We'll have less reliance. And people, it's like there's a brick wall of understanding. I think part of it is, as I'm reading your book, I'm thinking like, we're trying to change the system, but we're using all the same marketing tactics and finance structure as the existing system. Like, I think there's some tweaking there, but also just recognizing that we're saying something that just literally makes no sense to people, as if we were speaking whale song and it was just like background noise.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, this way of thinking is in everything. and so I think we're on a 500-year timeline of healing, yeah, one step at a time.
Right. And, the narrative, was it Guy McPherson, like, we're all going to be dead in 10 years. Mm-hmm. Like, there's, one of the things that I hear from people on my side is this.
He's been saying that for like 10 years, by the way.
Well, Nostradamus is eventually going to be right about everything too. So
go on.
Yeah. But the people on my side are saying like, this urgency means that there's no time for debate. There's no time for anything else. And what I think, like, one of the most beautiful things you did in the book is you kind of, for me at least, rehabilitated climate deniers, that they're not, idiots, rubes, evil people, but they have a worldview that I actually mostly share in terms of a distrust of the elites and the systems that have been, that have created this crisis.
Yeah. Right. Like, I do make the point, if the climate narrative is trust science, then are we also asking people to trust science when it says that GMOs are safe, or that, gosh, I'm not sure how much to come out of the closet here about all the things that I don't trust science about, but maybe you've had experiences in your life that blatantly contradict what science says is real and possible. A lot of people have.
Sure.
One of my close relatives was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and she, is using alternative modalities and has already outlived the diagnosis. I don't know what the end result will be, but these modalities, I mean, if you go on reason.com or quackwatch.com or something, they will be excoriated. They will be, there's nothing but contempt for how unscientific these modalities are. And in fact, now internet censorship is reaching a point where information that contradicts the establishment narrative, even in alternative health, it gets censored, So I'm like, yeah, I don't, if the message is trust authority, because science is part of the structure of authority, then that's not a very convincing message to me. I've got to have some other reasons than to trust that peer review and publishing and academia is working really well. So there is like this kind of anti-authoritarian streak in the climate skeptics that I appreciate. However, they are not at all receptive to my message, because I get the feeling that they are mostly, not all of them, but most of them are actually deniers. Even if they're right about certain aspects of climate change. And I'm not saying they are, but even if they are, their basic narrative is the climate change is a hoax, or, you know, climate change is a delusion, or climate change, whatever. Therefore, we've got nothing to worry about and we can continue to do anything we want on the earth. Like they are completely unwilling to say, actually, we're causing huge damage and we got to stop. And anything that contradicts that, they will shut it out. And that to me is what a denier is. So, yeah.
Right. But the very first chapter of the book, you talk about a conversation with someone who became an environmentalist because of his relationship with the land, because right. of love. You know, my neighbor, if we end up showing this on YouTube, behind me, 82-year-old veterinarian, right-wing Trump supporter, you know, Hillary's going to come and take away his guns, climate denier. He's preserved over 60 acres and put him in a conservation easement.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I don't get it, except that he also has the capacity to love and mourn loss.
I talked to someone else recently who's got this whatever in-law or something who's a rabid climate denier, Trump supporter, et cetera, and who also happens to be like a holistic rancher. And he loves his guns, you know, but he's like doing this rotational grazing and stuff and having massive increases of topsoil. Like in school, we learned that topsoil takes 500 years to build an inch of topsoil. But there are guys out there, you know, farmers and ranchers. And it's not just animal agriculture. There's many ways to build topsoil. But there are guys who are building an inch a year, you know, or an inch every couple of years, not 500 years. So like while he's, you know, espousing all these climate denying opinions, at the same time, he's actually doing more to sequester carbon than pretty much anybody else.
Right.
And that leads to the question, like, do we need the climate narrative, or do we need to make that front and center and defining of environmentalism, when maybe what we need to do is to invite people to fall back in love with nature, and to give them opportunities to take care of nature and to protect and restore what is beautiful.
Yeah, I think the last time I saw you were speaking in Chapel Hill, and you, in response to a question, you said, like, I don't want to live in a world in which someone who takes care of an elderly sick relative isn't valued as highly as anyone else. Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, what I want to get out of this interaction with you and with continuing to kind of read and take this vitamin is a deep knowing that I can make a difference. Even if I can't, you know, even if I can't, like, change world policy.
Right.
And can you talk just briefly about,
yeah,
like, how, like, maybe this could be the takeaway for this conversation is, what can I do? What can listeners do? What can ordinary people do to make the world a better place, the more beautiful place our hearts know is possible?
Yeah. So when we understand that climate change, or I would say ecological degeneration, is a symptom of everything about our society, then we know that any healing action that we take is going to, in time, be of benefit to the biosphere. Like, we know, for example, so suppose what you really care about is peace building. Well, it's impossible for humanity to be a healing presence on Earth if we are at war with each other. Because in war, the highest priority is to defeat the enemy. And you don't care what the collateral damage is to the environment. And your priority isn't going to be there. So people who are working for peace, they're also in service of the healing of Gaia. If your focus is even on a smaller level, it could be peace among members of your family or members of your community. That's also strengthening the field of peace that is ultimately of benefit to the world. And basically, What the Kogi are saying is that they're emphasizing the importance of ceremony to send a signal to Earth that we care about you. We want to be part of this healing. If you're sick and you're getting the message right and left that no one cares about you, how strong are you going to be in your healing? But so we need to send Earth the message that we care about you. Even if the rational mind says, well, if I plant a permaculture garden, that's not going to scale. That's not going to go viral. That's not going to change public policy. So what good does it do? But it sends a signal. It sends a message. It is a form of communication with the Earth. And the message is, I love you. I want you to stay. I care about you. It also, in the language of morphic resonance, it creates a morphogenetic field, or strengthens a morphogenetic field, which says, basically, this is Rupert Sheldrake's idea, that any change that happens in one place generates a field of change that allows it to happen more easily elsewhere. So we become part of a new reality, a reality in which we are in love with Earth. So through very conventional mechanisms, but also very esoteric mechanisms, any small action is part of a larger healing. I mean, it is impossible. Ultimately, it is impossible to have a healthy planetary climate and have a sick political climate or social climate or psychic climate. All of these things reflect each other. And that means that you can trust wherever your healing impulse draws you, whatever you care about, whatever has come up in your life, and understand that there is an intelligence beyond ourselves that knows how to make best use of us, and that communicates what that best use is through the organ of the heart that makes us care about something. That's a receiving of a message. Like, the message goes two ways. So Gaia is communicating to us, or the totality of life is communicating to us as well, through the function of what pierces us, what makes us care, what makes us want to devote our gifts to another being. Like, we can trust that we've been put in just the place that we're needed in order to be part of planetary healing.
That gets rid of a lot of second guessing, right? Which, yeah. Right, that's like my second job is like, well, I read Bessel van der Kolk, and I'm like, well, I really should do trauma work.
Right.
And then I read an environmentalist, like, oh no, I've got to be on Sea Shepherd,
Right.
Like, there's always somewhere else for me to be that's more important, as opposed to like that trust is, I think it's an analog of trusting, like, the Earth is going to give me the food I need and the connection I need, and my community is going to give me the love and support and direction that I need. That, and one of the things I love that you say in the book is that, there's this view that, well, the Earth will be fine without us. Like, okay, mm-hmm. Well, we are going away, but we deserve to. It's like, tough titty for you. You fucked it up, and now the world is going to go back to Eden eventually. And you point out, like, no, that's another form of exceptionalism, that somehow humans aren't needed here.
Yeah. In the news recently, there's been this guy in India who's suing his parents for giving birth to him without his consent. Did you read about that?
I think I saw something like that.
Yeah. And where he's coming from is humans are a scourge on this planet. There's too many of us. So he feels guilty, but he can't help being born. So it's his parents' fault. He didn't consent to that. So basically, it's coming from this guilt at being here on Earth. And what I would say to him, if I had the chance, I would say humans, at least in civilization, have been a scourge on the planet, but we don't have to be. Human impact doesn't have to be negative. There have been cultures that understood themselves to be caretakers of the land, servants of the land. And we could transition collectively into a relationship where we understand our purpose is to serve the healing and the evolution of Gaia. And to say, what is the dream of this Earth, and how do we participate in that? How do we serve that? and to trust that the planet produced us with all of our gifts for a reason, that we're not nature's one accident, the one bad species, and nature fucked up and made humans. But to begin asking, well, why were we created by life? To even ask that question already changes our perspective. It's a powerful question. It doesn't even have to have an answer, but it initiates a search and it induces an orientation to service. So I do believe that we are not nature's big mistake, and that we are Gaia's child. You could say to a mother, well, you know, your child is sick. If your child dies, you'll be fine. That would be pretty heartless and inaccurate. And I think Gaia loves us that much too, and really wants us to grow into our destiny, which is not to be the lords and masters of all creation. No, our destiny is to be the lovers of all creation. And I mean that in even like a sexual sense, like to co-create together, to give birth to something together, to give and receive in equal measure. That's our destiny.
Let's go out on that note. I've many, many, many more questions, and maybe for another time. But a lot of them are answered in your work. So I want everyone who's listening to this to go out and get at least one version of Climate: A New Story. I have the hardcover and the audiobook.
I didn't know there was a hardcover.
Not a hardcover, but actual. Paper.
You know, the trees,
physical book.
Yeah.
Like it's, you know, I have a part of a book club that does mostly like health and betterment topics. I'm going to push this one. I think this is such an important book for all of us to read, because it's an invitation to ease, even in the midst of this struggle, to finding our own strengths and to accepting ourselves on so many levels and so much healing. For people who want the entire oeuvre of your work, where can they find you and find out more and stay in touch?
Well, first, thank you for those kind words, Howard. Really appreciate that endorsement. My stuff is all on my website, charleseisenstein.org. So...
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. And you've got books, tons of articles, podcasts. You travel a lot. Doing workshops and talks.
Yeah, there's more and more kind of video and audio stuff. Online courses. I sometimes think people aren't reading anymore, so I need to communicate in other ways. But I'll get back to writing soon as well. I haven't done a lot of writing since I published the book. Yeah.
The sine wave, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, Charles, again, it was wonderful talking to you. I can't iterate enough how much of a balm your work has been for me for about a decade and a half. It's wonderful to have this time to connect with you.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I enjoyed it so much as well.
Cool. All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Well, I hope that was a lot of food for thought for you, as it has been for me. I do believe that Climate, A New Story is one of the most important books I've read in the last 10, 15 years. And I really would encourage you to get a copy, spread this message far and wide. I think it is a blueprint for how we can make it through this crisis, not only surviving, but transformed. To create this more beautiful world that our hearts do know is possible. As plant-based people, we know the kind of world we want to live in. And this message of how we heal our planet is not at all at odds with the message of plant-based living, of veganism. In fact, I think they're very close partners. Now, if you enjoyed this episode of the Plant Yourself podcast and you would like to support the mission of this show, there's a few ways to do it. You can subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or iTunes. You can become a patron of the show. If you go to patreon.com and you search for Plant Yourself, you can make an ongoing monthly contribution. It means a lot, both in financial terms, honestly, it helps me keep going, and in terms of psychological, spiritual, emotional support, knowing that there's people who value this work that I do, these hours that I put in every single week, enough to make a contribution that gets you virtually nothing in return. It's simply sort of living in the gift, as Charles Eisenstein would say, that I'm putting out a gift, and if you feel so called to return it in a way that that helps me with money, that would be awesome. And of course, another way is just to share this episode and others with people who would be interested. That's the goal here. The goal of this podcast is not to make money. The goal is to spread a message, is to raise consciousness. And, you know, the money is simply a means to help me keep doing this in bigger and bigger ways. So today's show is number 309. So you can find the show notes with links to Charles' site and to Climate, a New Story, in case you don't feel like looking it up yourself. You can find that at plantyourself.com/309. In garden news, we started putting up a deer fence, 7-foot fence. So we are only going to be allowing athletic deer to eat all our greens and our root vegetables in the garden. You know, the ones who can't jump higher than 7 feet are going to have to find their sucker elsewhere. And in running news, oh, not much going on. I've been not doing every day, so I've been trying to mix it up. I did a little bit of yoga yesterday, did martial arts today. I have a badass cut across my forehead. We were wrestling with knives. Now, these are plastic training knives, but I still got a bit of a cut, so I'm really ridiculously proud of how that looks. Okay, let's say thank you now. So, of course, thank you to Will Ridenour for allowing me to use his beautiful song, Sabali Dawn, The Dance of Peace. You can find more of Will's music at his website, willridenour.com. And, of course, thanks to all of you Plant Yourself podcast patrons, as in Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Anthony Disson, Brittany Porter, Dominic Mara, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hatherley, Mary Jane Wheeler, Ellen Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Burns, Christine Nielsen, Tina Scharf, Tina Ahern, Jen Bulkanowski, David Bizek, The Mysterious, Michelle X, Elspeth Feld, Victoria Dolomanoa, Leia Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Andrew, Josina Julianne, Roland Stu Dolnick, Sarah Durkis, Rhymes with Circus, Kelly Cameron, Wayne Peterson, Leanne Peterson, Janet, LB Claire Adams, Tom Franzek, Jeanette Bedden, Gil Lazer, David Donahue, Blair Seibert, Lorona Vizov, Gio and Carolyn Argentati, Jody Friesner, Ruth Ann Thunderberg, Misha Rosen, Michael Warabek, the equally mysterious Tracy Z, Alicia Lemus, Rebecca Hughes, Val Linneman, Rhymes with Cinnamon, Nick Harper, Stephanie Almas, Martha Bergner, Nicole Ramsey, Susan Ahmad, Molly Levine, the inscrutable Harry R, Susan Laverty, the Panda Vegan, Craig Kovic, Adam Sharp, Karen Burry, Heather Morgan, Ashley Corcoran, Kelly Machia, Deanne Norton, Bonnie Lynch, A Plant Happy Oregon, Sabina Kurtzels, Nigel Davies, Marion Blum, Teresa Copel, Shell Rootless, Julian Watkins, Breed O'Connell, Brian Sheridan, Shannon Hirschman, Kate Rosland, Ayat, Julie Langholm, Hedda Card, Iza Tuzinwa, Connie Hainline, Aaron Greer, Alicia Davis, Aviva Lael, Heather O'Connor, Carolyn Jensen, Sherry Orlikoski of Plant Powered for Health, Karen Smith, Scott Morani, Karen, Joe Crabtree, Tanya Lewis, Kirby Burton, Teresa Carell, Kevin McCauley, Elizabeth Rothschild, Kelly Baker, Miracle Ann, Jesse, Cheryl Dwyer, Generally, Jenny Hazelton, Valerie Peltier, Peter W. Evans, Colleen Harrison, Justine Divich, Joshua Sommermeyer, Dennis Bird, Darby Kelly, Lori, Fanny, Linnea, Lundquist, Valerie Hummel, Deb Casilla, Emily Iconelli, Levy Wallach, Rosamund McAtee, Dan Bicorni, Stephen Leenan, Patty DiMartino, Mike and Donna Cards, Deanne Bishop, Bill Burry Elf, Gunter Schmidt, Marjorie Lewis, Kelly Molden, Trisha Adams, Ian Kramer, Nancy Sheldon, Lindsay Bayshore, Gunn Marie Hagen, and Tracy Gullidge for your generous support of this podcast. That's it for this week. As always, be well, my friends.